The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Thank you for joining us here on the Frank Sontag Show. We begin this hour, as well as every hour, with our impact segment. 20-plus minutes of uninterrupted dialogue and discussion. My next guest is a man I've not met in person, but I've had on a number of times, and I could not speak in a more revered and honored way about Pat Williams. This man has done so much in his life. He's a former sports executive. He's in the NBA Hall of Fame. He's the senior vice president of the Orlando Magic. He's written more than 100 books. He's done a number of things in his life physically, like running marathons. He is a cancer survivor. I can be here till tomorrow telling you how much I love and respect my guest, author of the new book, Revolutionary Leadership: Essential Lessons from the Men and Women of the American Revolution, Pat Williams. Welcome back to the Frank Sontag Show.
Well, Frank, I'm so pleased to be on with you. It's wonderful to catch up with you, and I'm looking forward to our chat.
I am as well, and if my memory serves me, and I may be wrong, one of the recent interviews we did a number of months ago, you had written a book on Coach Wooden.
That's correct, Frank. I think I've written 4 books on Coach Wooden. I just became fascinated with that man. Not only his coaching acumen and his tremendous results at UCLA, but he lived his life the right way. There are not that many people you can look up to as heroes and models to base your life on. Coach Wooden's one of them.
Yeah.
And I just became intrigued with him, and he was so kind to me in the latter years of his life. He let me come into his life, and it was a great, great experience, and I always kept hoping he was pleased with the books we did.
Mm. Now, before we speak of your new book, Revolutionary Leadership, one question about you. I'll ask it rhetorically, but I would love you to just comment on it in any way that you are struck by. Speaking so highly of Coach Wooden, I introduced you in similar tones, and I suspect that you have touched a lot of people in your life. You have led an extraordinary life, Pat, and when it comes to leadership, I think there are a lot of people that look to you about what you've done and the number of areas that you've accomplished and your love for God and your inspiration. Anything you want to share about your own life, your upbringing, God, your faith, and then we'll jump into this incredible new book that you've just penned.
Well, I think it would be interesting to look back about where I started, Frank. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. My dad was a high school history teacher and baseball coach. My mother was a homemaker, homekeeper. But, boy, she had a great love for American history as well. And being in Wilmington, you're very close to Philadelphia, where so much of the start of our country actually happened, and you can go see it. And as a youngster, I was exposed to those experiences there. And as the years went on, I became even more intrigued with the start of our country. But underlying it all, Frank, is this one single word called leadership. I played the leadership positions in sports. I was a quarterback, a point guard, a catcher. But back in my day, back in the 40s and the 50s, you never heard that word leadership. But now, well, it's become a whole industry unto itself. You can get PhDs in leadership, and leadership books are out there by the score, but I thought it was important to go back and combine my love for American history and my love for leadership and see what we could come up with this new book. And, well, we focused on 25 people, men and women of that period. And without their leadership and without their courage and without their boldness, well, we wouldn't have a country today, Frank. I think it's pretty direct. And so we studied these leaders, wrote about them, and at the end of each chapter we list the leadership lessons that we can take from these men and women, many of them famous, many of them not, but they all played a huge role in the start of the United States.
Pat Williams' new book is Revolutionary Leadership, Essential Lessons from the Men and Women of the American Revolution. Now, you've written 25 chapters, 25 men and women. I would imagine you had more to pick from, and then you whittled down to 25, correct? And if so, maybe you'd like to share one of the many stories in the book, maybe a handful on some that you did choose to write chapters about.
Well, Frank, great question. And obviously, you're going to have a chapter on George Washington, and you're going to have a chapter on Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, James Madison, et cetera. However, I think my favorite chapters would be around Lafayette.
Mm.
19 years old, he catches wind. He's from France. He catches wind of what's going on over here on this continent. And he comes across the ocean by himself, 19 years old, gets off the ship in South Carolina Harbor, somehow wins his way north and encounters George Washington. What are the odds, huh? Mm-hmm. And so Washington embraces this young man. Washington never had children of his own. I think Lafayette was almost kind of like a surrogate son. And the next thing you know, Lafayette is in the middle of battles, the Battle of Brandywine. He's there at Yorktown at the end of the war. I mean, he's a soldier. Of course, he then goes back to France and runs into all sorts of problems with the French Revolution. But I think here's the tip-off on Lafayette. After the war, many years later, he comes back to the United States to tour this new nation that he loves so much. He's greeted just as an incredible hero. And as you look at the map of the United States, Frank, we've got Lafayette, Louisiana.
Yeah, that's right.
And we've got Lafayette, Indiana. And we've got Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania. And on it goes. That was the 19-year-old who came over here by himself to aid the cause. I'm fascinated with Lafayette.
Now, as we maybe talk further about some of those you wrote about in your book, Revolutionary Leadership, I just have to ask this question. And you, in the foreword, I think Brian Kilmeade wrote, first sentence, who can deny that America is in a crisis today? Like, we are in serious situations right now. And my question is, extrapolating some of the leaders of past years to today, are we missing something today about real, true concepts of leadership?
Boy, that's a good question. Let me take a stab at it this way, Frank. I've got a good friend. His name is Sven Nader.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Played under Coach Wooden, yeah. And had a long NBA career, works for Costco. But, boy, he deep down, Sven is a poet. And knowing of my love for leadership and the importance of it, Sven put this together for me a few years ago. Let me just share it with you. 7 things one must do to be a leader, right and true. Have vision that is strong and clear. Communicate so they can hear. Have people skills based in love. And character that's far above. The competence to solve and teach, and boldness that has fearless reach, a serving heart that stands close by to help, assist, and edify. I think that's a summation, Frank, of leadership excellence. And all we need leaders of excellence in our government and in our businesses. In our athletic world and in the church, in educational fields, we need 7-sided leaders. And hopefully this new book will assist in that effort to try and stimulate this next generation of leaders and get them moving.
The new book that Pat makes reference to is Revolutionary Leadership. He picked many different leaders of the American Revolution, European, African descent, in various walks of light, not just everybody here necessarily that you would think of with the revolution and what happened in our country in the early stages. One chapter that I was reading the other night that I'd love to hear your comments on is the one that you wrote on Sarah Bradley Fulton, the mother of the Boston Tea Party. First of all, I didn't know who she was, and I found not only some of her actions, but the leadership that she exemplified really quite staggering, especially in light of today in my own little narrative. I think we're hurting for true leadership today, but her life really epitomized a woman that understood what it meant to be a leader.
Frank, I hope that maybe this book will stimulate interest in her. I think she's worthy of a statue in Boston. She's worthy of, and maybe it's been done, of a full biography. But in a nutshell, when the ultimate piece of that rebellion was going on and they decided that all this tea that had come across the ocean, they were going to dump it. And they knew that that was going to antagonize Great Britain, I mean, to the nth degree. But there was Sarah, and had the idea of getting these men dressed up as Native Americans. Right. And she helped design the costumes. And she was the architect of the whole thing, as we got into it. But we really don't know about her. But, boy, you talk about a leader. In the moment of crisis, there she was. And it seemed throughout that period that leaders just kept popping up. They kept popping up almost out of nowhere. For example, Frank, and we all know the horrible, horrible winter of 1776 in Valley Forge, and how brutal it was, and how unpleasant it was, and soldiers dying off, and they were just sitting in those little log huts, and who appears but Baron von Steuben, a Prussian, and he came across unknown and volunteered to Washington. Well, as it turns out, he had a terrific skill of getting these troops organized and teaching them how to march. These were farm boys, basically, and von Steuben whipped them into shape. Told them how to handle a weapon and how to march and how to act like soldiers. And he didn't speak much English. His language was crude. But I don't know that we would have been ready to win the war if it wasn't for Baron von Steuben. Hmm. So he's a fascinating character that we dug into. And Washington turned it over to him.
Yep, he sure did.
And so there's a leadership skill right there. It was called delegating. And Washington was good at that. He didn't think for a minute that he could do it all by himself. And he was willing to delegate authority when he saw the need. And he turned that whole training program over to von Steuben. Great, great story.
Pat, recently, I have a men's ministry. I did a series of Zoom meetings with some of my guys on my take on Christian leadership, not the end all, not that somehow I've got it all figured out. But one of the two things that really stood out, and the guys were kind of shocked that I had these two positions. Number one, I said, if you're not leading, if you're not criticized, you're not leading. And they were like, tell us more about that, because we see in this day and age, and I don't want to get necessarily talking to the depths of what's going on in the country with cancel culture and censorship and all that. But I said, look, stop playing the middle of the road. A leader is one that sees a vision in a selfless manner that goes because they know they are true and right in their assessment. And there'll be other people that will go yay. There'll be other people that will go nay. But if you're not being criticized in some ways, you're not truly leading.
Frank, it's hard to argue with that. And none of us like criticism. None of us enjoy it. But if you're out there and have stuck your neck out, just expect it. Tony La Russa, the Hall of Fame manager, has a interesting take on that. Tony has said that he doesn't like criticism, but he gets it. But he said it doesn't bother him. He said, because I'm more critical of myself than I am of anybody criticizing me. So he said, I think I can blunt the criticism because from the outside, because I'm criticizing myself more harshly than they are when a situation just doesn't work or whatever. So that's just another slant on it. Something interesting to talk about.
For sure. Pat Williams' new book, Revolutionary Leadership. Pat, in your epilogue, literally the last paragraph reads as follows, and I'd love your comments. The American experiment is ongoing. The story of America is still being written. What part will you play in these critical times? How will you choose to lead? We are in some serious times right now, and I often lament, where are all the leaders? Where are the real people that will step up and not only lead our country or maybe lead the church? Because there's a lot of confusion, a lot of deception, and a lot of fear out there.
Oh, Frank, that's a topic probably you could dive into for hours. It takes courage to be a good leader. As we study these leaders in this book, Frank, I don't think any of them were what you would call natural leaders. And that begs the question, are leaders born or made?
Yep.
I think the answer is both. Number one, every leader I'm aware of at some point was born. And at some point, every leader made a decision that this is my moment and I've got to step up here. We wrote a book a year ago called The Reluctant Leader. And how reluctant leaders are thinking and how they can get over being a reluctant leader. Because whether you're leading in your Little League baseball community or whether you're leading your high school pep band, I don't care what it is, step up and lead.
Yeah.
Don't be reluctant.
Pat, on
and
a...
People,
go ahead.
People want you to lead, Frank. People are rooting for you.
For sure.
They want you to do well.
To jump on that, your book on West Point and the benches was a life-changing moment for me. I knew of the benches. I've had a good friend whose son went through West Point and some other people, but yet you talk about the epitome pillars of leadership that we can learn from. They're there, and yet, I don't want to spin the end here in anything other than the promotion of your book and the great work that you've done throughout your life. And I'll just be honest, I am concerned about even the understanding of what true leadership looks like in this day and age.
Well, Frank, I don't think there's a carbon copy that all leaders look this way and talk this way and have this kind of personality. I think we've got bombastic leaders. I think we also have withdrawn leaders, quiet leaders, but we need them. And it's interesting, you just brought that point up. I guess a year before last, we wrote a book, Character Carved in Stone. And we wrote about those 12 benches on the West Point campus in a place called Trophy Point, looking out over the Hudson River, and carved into each bench was a different word. And the words were meant to plant seeds in the hearts of all of these cadets up there, that's how they're to live their lives. And so we did a chapter on each word and then tried to find a West Point example who exemplified that word. Ulysses S. Grant, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Douglas MacArthur, and others that weren't well known, but it was fascinating to see that whole thing unfold, and I'm glad you brought that book up, Frank.
It's a wonderful book, as many of your books are. Your new one, Revolutionary Leadership. Two questions in closing. Anything more you want to make mention of about your new book? And then I always end our interviews because you've written more than 100 books. I'm always interested in what you're working on now. But anything more you want to say about your latest Revolutionary Leadership?
Well, it's in bookstores, fortunately, Barnes & Nobles, and Amazon is a wonderful way to get books. It's like Christmas morning when that little box arrives, and so I would encourage people to do that, and get ready for a good read, and you must have a pen or a pencil in your hand, because I think you're going to come across material as you read through that you want to mark and fold the page down. And maybe later Xerox it out of there, something that really strikes you. Mm-hmm. And pay very close attention at the end of each chapter, the leadership lessons from each of these American heroes, and see how that might apply to your life as a leader. Mm-hmm. So that would be, I think that's the word I would want to share here, Frank.
Wonderful. And what is life like these days for Pat Williams? Are you in the process of writing another book? How are you? How's your life? How's your health?
My health is good, Frank. I was diagnosed 11 years ago with multiple myeloma, mm-hmm. One of the blood cancers, and I've done well with it. I've responded well to all the forms of chemo. I feel good. My energy level's good. We're working on trying to bring Major League Baseball to Orlando. That's the next big sports adventure. And I've got a number of books that we're coming out along the way here. One is a sports or athletes devotional book, and a sports devotional book that'll be coming. And we're working on another book called The Power of Empowerment. Hmm. And how people along the way with just a word. It may be in sports or politics, but it didn't matter. Just a word or just a little word of encouragement and what it did to their lives and their careers. That book's in the works right now. And there are others. I've got a list of 50 books I want to write, Frank, that are still hot in my brain. And we'll see how many of them I can get to.
Yeah, well, I don't know of anybody that's written as many as you have, and good to know you've got many more in the hopper and percolating and working and praying and being such an inspiration to so many of us. Let me share again. Pat Williams is author of the new book, Revolutionary Leadership, Essential Lessons from the Men and Women of the American Revolution. Pat, anytime I can spend a few moments with you and either talk about your book or your outlook on life is time well spent, and I'm very blessed to know you. Pat, thank you for doing so much for God's kingdom and for so many of us that, well, maybe need to understand a little bit more from a perspective that is worth noting and spending time, whether it's our history, whether leadership, whether faith, and you're one of the very few at the forefront that has been doing that for many a decades. We thank you for that.
Thanks a million, Frank. Good to chat with you, and my very best from Orlando to all your listeners.
Yes, amen. We'll pray about that baseball team, too.
Okay, thank you, Frank. Okay.
All right, Pat.
Take care.
You do the same.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Pat Williams, wonderful man, and talking about Orlando baseball, that's a story in and of itself. I'd love to maybe talk to Pat more about that in a future program. 888-528-2557. We will continue with more of this, the Frank Sontag Show, next. Welcome back to the Frank Sontag Show. Thank you for joining us. My thanks again to Pat Williams, always willing to spend time with us. His books are phenomenal, and they're very easy reads. And I'll say that with a caveat. Sad truth is many of you don't read. That's just the state of things. We don't sit and read books. We stare at screens. But I will tell you, Pat is such a resource when it comes to life and faith. In his new book, revolutionary leadership is one and the same. And I just want to speak for a moment to the lies of what we hear so much with cancel culture and critical race theory and the founding of the country. Why would he write about men and women that helped create the American Revolution and get us through the tough times? Well, if you get hung up on that, you may miss, at the very least, the human interest aspect of each and every one of these people. Some people you may never have heard of, where from the testimony of their life, they may help you today with something you're struggling with. So I appreciate Pat very much and his writing skills. And speaking of leadership and our country, not sure if you saw this one, with a big no comment, in recent days, President Joe Biden has canceled a proposed, quote, National Garden of American Heroes, end quote, had been planned by the previous president, would have included statues of dozens of figures from history, including the likes of Billy Graham and Harriet Tubman. Then President Donald Trump issued two executive orders to establish the garden, one in July of last year, another in January of this year. Last month, Joe Biden signed an executive order of his own revoking multiple executive orders. We know Joe Biden has been fast at hand with that pen, including both executive orders relating to the Heroes Garden. There's no reason for canceling the monument. They just did it with a big no comment. National Garden of American Heroes would have been constructed outdoors at a yet-to-be-determined site. It's pretty sad when you realize people like Billy Graham, John Adams, Susan B. Anthony, Aretha Franklin, Clara Barton, Frederick Douglass, Amelia Earhart, Martin Luther King Jr., Jackie Robinson, Harriet Tubman. No, according to the new administration, they're not worthy of a garden or a series of monuments by which we can relearn and teach about history and the exemplary lives of these people. The executive order by the previous administration in terms of the garden read, quote, each individual has been chosen for embodying the American spirit of daring and defiance, excellence and adventure, courage and confidence, loyalty and love. Astounding the world by the sheer power of their example, each one of them has contributed indispensably to America's noble history, the best chapters of which are still to come, end quote. And the new administration, not interested. I don't know if you caught what happened yesterday at the G7 summit. Joe Biden got, well, confused when they were going around introducing the leaders of the room. He evidently missed the South African president was introduced by Boris Johnson and kind of blurted out. And then Boris Johnson kind of corrected him in a way. I don't know if you've seen the video, but kind of, I don't know, treating him like he was a little boy or something. And Nicarama writes a lot of editorials. I just want to read his take on it. Maybe you have a comment for this segment only. Next segment. A pastor sent me a sermon that he did recently. I want to read the entire sermon to you, and I want to make lots of time for it. 888-528-2557. Nicarama writes, Johnson asked to correct Biden and say that he already mentioned the South African president, to which Biden appeared to say he didn't hear it. Everyone laughs. That's actually more embarrassing than just being confused about who was introduced. Biden seems out of it and doesn't seem to understand that. Right about that point, the Sky News reporter comes in and tries to say something and is shut down. Rama writes, part of the problem of having Biden go to these meetings is there's only so much the handlers can control. So there's going to be issues. On top of that, he's already signaled the days of putting America first are going to be over while he's in power. You may have caught recently his commentary about other countries, not so much America. Rama writes, we're in deep trouble with this guy in charge right now, and the only thing that might be worse than his incompetence might be the person who would take over. Who would that be? Are you referring to somebody? How's our border doing, huh? Border's closed. Don't come. 888-528-2557. So we talk about issues of culture, cancel culture, the Equality Act. A pastor sent me a sermon. I'm not going to mention him because I didn't get pre-approved. I didn't tell him I was going to read it, but this is kind of spontaneous. He sent me his entire sermon. I want to read it to you on the other side. It is powerful. And if only more pulpits would preach like this. We will share that story next here on the Frank Sontag Show. Welcome back to the Frank Sontag Show. Thank you for joining us. It's rare that I have a pastor reach out to me these days, let alone share with me his sermon. And recently I got an email from a local pastor who just felt compelled to share a sermon. Now, I probably won't be able to get to all of it in the 14 minutes I have, but let me try to jump right in. I don't want to give him attribution because I've not run this by him. But the words are very powerful, and let me just share a little bit. The sermon is called The Demonic Power of the Equality Act, Critical Theory and Cancel Culture. Soon after beginning his ministerial career in England in 1852, William Booth abandoned the concept of the traditional church pulpit in favor of taking the gospel of Jesus Christ directly to the people. Walking the streets of London, he preached to the poor, the homeless, the hungry, and the destitute. Richard Collier, the historian of the Salvation Army, says, quote, persecution was great from the beginning. Gangs frequently hurled mud and stones through the windows at the preaching and the crowd. The liquor dealers worked hard to have Booth kicked out of East London. The police were no help. In fact, they often broke up outdoor meetings and accused Booth's followers of being the cause of all the trouble. Beatings were not uncommon. In 1889, at least 669 Salvation Army members were assaulted. Some were killed. Many were maimed. Even children were not immune. Ruffians threw lime in the eyes of a child of a Salvation Army member. The newspapers ridiculed Booth. They referred to him as, quote, Field Marshal von Booth, end quote. This is according to Richard Collier. Just like what happened to William Booth, persecution and rejection was and is a real part of the Christian mission. Paul and his band of missionaries were traveling all over Europe, sharing the gospel, planting churches. This sounds great, but not everyone was excited about it. God was graciously working, but Satan was at work too. Let's pick up our story in Acts 16, verse 16. Once when we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a slave girl who had a spirit by which she predicted the future. She earned a great deal of money for her owners by fortune-telling. This girl followed Paul and the rest of us, shouting, these men are servants of the Most High God who are telling you the way to be saved. Acts 16, verses 16 through 17. This poor girl was demonized, filled with a demonic spirit who revealed the future to her clients. She was owned by spiritual pimps who sold her out to share her metaphysical powers. Satan's strategy here was obvious. He wanted to derail the gospel by infiltrating it, by forming an apparent alliance with Christ's work, for his own ends, of course. On one hand, she's telling the truth, but on the other hand, who would want to partner with a demon-possessed woman? The pastor writes, this leads me to the first point I want to make. Satan loves to distort the gospel and truth just enough to twist it into a deadly heresy. We see this playing out in our culture today through the critical theory and cancel culture. Critical theory is a study of how to break something like gender, sexuality, marriage, justice, or Christianity. Anyone who has ever tried to break something knows how easy this is. Why? Because criticizing the imperfect work of another fallen sinner is a lot harder than actually doing the hard work of building something better. It's like expecting an out-of-shape guy who's yelling at world-class athletes to get on the field and do a better job. In economics, critical theory attacks wealth and success. In gender studies, critical theory attacks men and masculinity. In marriage studies, critical theory attacks traditional view marriage. Sexuality studies, critical theory attacks sex, gender, and marriage. In race, critical theory attacks the white and the privileged. In the church, critical theory attacks God, creation, intelligent design, and absolute truth. The list is endless and hypocrisy is limitless. It's gone so far that just this week, Hasbro announced that it would drop the Mr. from the brand name in order to be more inclusive and so all could feel welcome in the Mr. Potato Head world. The myth under critical theory is that we can make a utopian society like heaven on earth without God. If we simply criticized and tore down everyone and everything we do not like, then we could rebuild in its place a more just and good society. Only problem is that everyone is a sinner. Everything we build is faults, flaws, and failures because the fall extends to everything we think and everything we do. When the Bible speaks of Satan the accuser, Revelation 12:10, it's another way of saying he is the critic who condemns people. Critic loves nothing more than getting sinners on earth to take God's seat, judge others, condemn them, and then punish them to some sort of hellish fate. Today's technology provides those who sit in judgment endless opportunities to critique and condemn. Today we call this cancel culture, and the reason it's so powerful is because behind it all is Satan. Unlike God who forgives, there can be no forgiveness and only condemnation for those who have done wrong. They must be canceled, never forgiven, banished to live in shame forever under the demonic spirit of condemnation, with no hope of ever getting the kind of grace and new life that Jesus Christ alone provides. And the pastor writes, and I'm sure I'm going to get some emails for preaching this because, as it seems, the unpardonable sin of critical theory and cancel culture is to critique critical theory and cancel the cancel culture. But I believe that the Bible says in Romans 8:1, there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. People don't get canceled with Christ. People get forgiveness and a new life to live for the glory of God and the good of others. You get new eyes to see the world as it is, a new heart to lie for the glory of God, and the high call to partner with Jesus in redeeming what sin has broken. Satan is at work in our world, just as he was in Philippi as recorded in Acts 16. Luke just had the courage to call it as it was. This girl had a demonic spirit in her. Whatever initial inclinations were for Paul and his team, they did not fall for the devil's bait. Perhaps he remembered that every time a demon confirmed that Christ was the Son of God, Jesus rebuked it every time. He always silenced them and ordered them to leave. In Acts 16, Satan kept the pressure on for several days. It was his first and best approach. But Paul responded a lot like Jesus. Look at verse 18. She kept this up for many days. Finally, Paul became so troubled that he turned around and said to the Spirit, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to come out of her." At that moment, the Spirit left the young girl. What a great moment in the life of this woman. She was restored to her right mind, and I presume she received Christ. But God's power had worked a miracle in her life, and she was free from this demonic oppression. Verse 19 points out another opposing side of the story we can relate to in our time. When the owners of the slave girl realized that their hope of making money was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to face the authorities. They brought them before the magistrates and said, "These men are Jews, and they're throwing our city into an uproar by advocating customs unlawful for us Romans to accept or practice." The crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas, and the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten. Acts chapter 16, verses 19 through 22. Paul and Silas were in trouble because they had exercised the girl's owner's source of income. Pastor writes, this leads me to my next point. Whenever the preaching of the gospel touches the economic structure of the powers that be, opposition is bound to come. Paul had touched the profiteers' hearts. The problem was their hearts were in their wallets. In the ensuing melee, false charges and racial innuendo were arrayed against Paul and Silas, and their arrest followed. Note how quickly the devil changed tactics. When first tactics did not work, he tried outward persecution. Satan's tactics are the same. Money and power rule the day, and if you oppose, you're canceled. You could be persecuted, charged, maybe even jailed. Pastor writes in closing, I have to agree with the Bible when it says there is nothing new under the sun. I pray that God will give us all eyes to see, ears to hear, boldness to call it out, and may we continue to trust in God and fight the good fight of faith. Come, Lord Jesus, come. Now, I want to share a thought in the moment we have. I skipped a little bit of the sermon. And I don't want to minimize anything. The pastor probably spent 30 hours crafting and honing this. But one of the many messages I derive from this is, if you stand for right, if you stand for truth, you're going to pay a price. Think about today. Cancel culture is alive and well. Or even if you make your faith known publicly. We have platforms now. Social media. I took quite a break from Twitter. Not really have gone on other than to just peruse a little bit here and there. And not that Twitter speaks reflectively for the entire world, but you want to see vile, reprehensible, reprobate minds? Tune into Twitter for a while. What is accepted as truth can be a lie. What's a lie sometimes is represented as truth. But Christian, what are we doing in this time by which God gives us? Using the pastor's analogy, eyes to see, a mouth to speak, a heart to sense. What are we doing? Are we even in right control of our faculties? You know, my son dropped a nugget on me the other day on our prayer walk. We've been doing prayer walks a little bit lately. We were watching, before we went out for the walk, some inane program on, what was the channel? You know, one of those channels. In the bottom right-hand corner, it had an icon of the flag, the rainbow flag. And every once in a while, it would flash, you know, celebrate Pride Month and this and that. I think it was TV Land. My son looks at me on the walk and says, Dad, I have a question. So we have Pride Month for an entire month, and we have Memorial Day for just one day. The mind of a 13-year-old. And I said, that's the reality of where we're at right now. And then we just start talking about Jesus on the walk. What's he's doing in my son's life, what he's doing in my life right now. What is he doing in your life right now? Last thought, we interviewed Pat Williams at the beginning of the hour on leadership. Maybe our king is calling you to be a leader and you're like, not so sure I'm comfortable with that one. Whatever it may be. Doesn't have to be some high profile leadership or group or nonprofit. Could just being a leader in your community, in your home, or being a mom and her dad and popping up in front of the school board and challenging them on some of the policies that they want to implement and force on our children. You'll pay a price in some ways, but to just kind of hide out and go the way of submission, reminded by a gym owner of all people a number of months ago, say, yeah, just stay home, put your mask on and shut up. what's the expression? Paraphrasing, you know, bad people only exist because good people do nothing. So how say you? What is God calling to you to do in this season, in this day and age? By truly the power of Christ. Maybe we will weigh in on that on this program or even a future program. This is the Frank Sontag Show.